thank you for that warm reception. It is very interesting that our subject this morning should deal with conserving energy resources, because I just ran out of some. So I'm going to listen attentively to my lecture and see if I can improve myself as I go along. If you can't hear, let us know, and Gilbert will raise the microphone. I'm trying to save myself from laryngitis. This morning, we do have an interesting theme, and that has to do with the conserving of the basic energy resources of the human being. Paracelsus von Hohenheim, as a result of his studies in Constantinople, received from the Arab physicians and philosophers the astronomical concept that there are three suns in our solar system. The one that at the small end is the one we see. There are two others making a triad, and the planets revolve around the entire group. Of these suns, one is visible and two are invisible. One provides energy to the forms and bodies of things, and the others two supply energy to the invisible parts of nature. Not only of nature around us, but human nature within ourselves. The human being has, according to this concept, three basic sources of energy. One of these sources is his spiritual sun, the divine principle of universal energy, which is disseminated throughout all time and space. The second is a kind of soul energy, that it develops the various faculties, parts, and members of the human personality. The soul energy has as its disseminating processes the planets which revolve about the sun. The planets become the differentiators of thought, emotion, vitality, all kinds of specialized forms of energy usage, and finally also energy depletion. The third source of this energy works upon the physical forms of things and is more or less represented by that great battery which we call the planet Earth. To the ancients, the Earth was a reservoir of energies. It was the container upon which all energies converge to be transformed into the processes of form building. The energy of the Earth is physical. It has to do with the growth and structure of physical processes in nature. It therefore may be regarded as the source of nutrition. Nutrition being basically a dissemination of physical energy over the field of its own activities, namely physical forms in life. Also, the physical energy takes charge of the actions and locomotions of things. It has to do with the growth of plants. It has to do with the gradual development of forms and their maintenance throughout nature. And the highest form of this energy, of course, is interrelated with some of the higher forms in the processes of generation or the reproduction of species. Another point that is, I think, very interesting to consider, and that is that part of the solar rays reaching the Earth are bounced from the surface of the moon. So the moon becomes a kind of subsidiary source of energy. But its energy is a very peculiar and particular kind. Through the old Arabs and Persians, the lunar energy was the source of psychic phenomena. In other words, it is the source of that kind of energy resource that is used in magic, sorcery, and many types of esoteric disciplines and doctrines. The tendency, however, of the lunar force is to be disintegrative. It has a tendency to break down more than it can produce, and also to lead into fantasy and phantoms. The moon is the magic mirror of antiquity, in which all the processes of nature are more or less mirrored, and in terms of magic, sorcery, metaphysical activities of all kinds. Now, these types of activities result in a combination of circumstances. The activities themselves call upon energy resources. The activities called upon under such conditions are not part of the straight growth in nature. Therefore, it is necessary to recognize a conflict between the natural processes of growth and the processes of psychic phenomena. Now, this does not mean that this phenomena is not genuine. It means, however, that it is peculiarly subject to fantasy. It is nocturnal. It has to do with the strange creatures of dreams, fantasy, magic, and to a certain degree, psychology. Psychology has really, somewhere along the line, to pause and solve the mystery of the effect of the moon upon the psychological integration of the human being. This is a very important point, but as yet comparatively unnoticed. Yet if you go through the old mythologies, you go through the old imageries, you find very often the lunar crescent tied into the hair of the god Shiva or one of the other ancient deities. Not simply because it is a humid principle, but because it is a principle of fascination, a principle that was captured by the Greeks and the goddess Diana, the huntress, and in many other religious symbols and systems. Now, the human being as he is, a composite of the elements of the solar system, is constituted very much like the solar system in his principles. If we can completely study his magnetic field and the entire auric structure behind the body, we will see that we are in the presence of a little solar system, as Bamby pointed out. The whole solar system is located or is epitomized in the human structure. Therefore, there is a spiritual source of energy in man, which corresponds to the first of the three invisible suns. There is a mystical or vital force, a secondary sun, invisible, corresponding to the soul. In this, man is also equipped. Then there is the physical sun in man, by means of which all of the body functions are maintained within his own structure, much as in the same way as in the solar system itself. The three suns in man are the heart, the brain, and the reproductive center. And these are the principal administrators of energy. There is also a psychic field associated with the solar plexus, which again becomes the counterpart of the lunar influence. All of these factors taken into consideration would form a very interesting study, and it's more or less of a pity that modern thinkers haven't recognized the dramatic importance of trying to investigate the invisible. Locked within the visible, and yet at the same time fully aware that the visible is suspended from something they cannot see, too many learned persons simply discard the possibility of making the parallels which might be of the greatest value in solving human problems. Actually, our problem this morning is essentially, how are we going to use these energies? We have, therefore, three legitimate forms of energy that we have to use, and one doubtful form. We have a spiritual energy, which, of course, actually is available to us in only one way, and that way is through the complete harmonization of the structure of which we are composed. Spiritual energy can only manifest on its own level. Therefore, it can only manifest in organisms in which all factors or circumstances that are contrary to spirit have been overcome or eliminated. Therefore, it becomes a pure supporter of man's most vital, invisible, unknown factor, his own spirit. The spirit is not only the source of his life, but it is also the central point from which the energy of his life is suspended. Therefore, the spiritual sun being the highest, manifesting through a triad of energy factors, becomes the source of all energy and is related to the cosmic and space energy in its largest and most abstract fields. Now, the secondary is the, which you might call, the rational energies. These have to do with the mind, with the development of the body, with the laws and rules governing knowledge, with the expansion of arts and sciences, and the supporting of ideals, convictions, integrities. And here is where we have one of our major difficulties. We have within the individual the possibility of using these energies as he himself chooses to use them. As a result of that, these energies are often in conflict. And where this conflict exists, it becomes a major factor in the depletion of the physical resources of the individual. The conflicts between attitudes, then, become one of the major sources of the depletion of the energy which maintains the human being on the level of the human being. It is therefore very important that each individual reconcile the parts of himself. He must reunite a sort of family relationship. He must get away from the push and pull of conflicting pressures, which are due to conflicting ambitions, attitudes, and emphases on the various levels of his skills, his ideals, and his integrities. The individual whose convictions are not supported by his conduct, for instance, is bound to be in trouble. He is bound to deplete his energy resources. He destroys them. He creates toxins in them. He pollutes them as air could be, or water can be polluted. It is therefore most important that the individual shall overcome the negative pressures of his own mental, emotional focus. Now, many people today are making quite a project out of becoming spiritual. They hope very much that they're going to be able to transcend the limitations and problems of daily living. Very many of these people, however, are not doing too well. One of the main reasons is that they have not placed a proper censorship upon their own conduct. Individuals who are seeking spiritual integrities and spiritual values cannot compromise the ordinary affairs of life. The individual who is still seeking power, seeking wealth, seeking superiority, desiring to join a kind of spiritual aristocracy by which he is better than ordinary mortals, this type of person is not gaining anything from his efforts to be spiritual. No amount of disciplines, no amount of dedications can overcome weaknesses of conduct. The main point always is to build conduct, to bring the energy fields into balance, and to conserve all resources so that energy is available for the highest possible purposes, so that this energy is available almost completely for the unfoldment, discipline, and growth of the higher nature itself. Where most of this energy is still used in bickering and conflicts in the personal life and on the personal level of action, there cannot be very much essential spirituality floating around. Now, the energy that's getting into trouble is largely emotional energy. It is the energy of the second sun. It is the energy of the emotional mental being, therefore, very largely of what we would term the individuality. It is this type of energy that is the person as we know it today. And it is this person that is in trouble. And this person remains in trouble as long as he attempts to advance his personality and his personal purposes without consideration for his integrities. People come to me quite frequently with these problems. One of the most common, of course, is the individual who is trying desperately to be spiritual and has kindly come to the conclusion that by some circumstance, membership of something of this nature, he has finally found that superiority. He has finally found what others seek in vain, and that is the possibility of a unique attainment in spiritual growth. He is going to be better than other people, wiser, more wonderful. He's going to have a strange superiority over everything else. In other words, he is bound toward an achievement of spiritual aristocracy. He wishes to be an aristocrat in the celestial kingdom. This is not possible. It is a deadly mistake and a terrible waste of energy. The Zen people are much wiser in this. They realize that energy that is held in suspension and therefore is not motivating any destructive action is the most important energy of all. The energy that we use is mostly abused, but the energy that we hold in a transitional state, we hold in a suspension, is available but not necessarily used until it is needed. So all energy should be stored, not wasted. But when the time comes when it should be used, it should be used fully and adequately. We need all available energy with which to grow. We need all available energy to serve our brother man. We own so little in this world that our energy is not to be directed upon our possessions, but upon the improvement of the society to which we belong. All selfishness ends in a short circuit in the energy fields of the human body. Every abuse of energy has its karmic consequence, and karma is largely a matter of compensation for abuse. Whereas if the individual does not break the rules, he does not have to worry about the karmic reactions. But karmic reactions are always punishment for broken rules. And we need to bear this in mind constantly, because in an effort to misuse the purposes for which we were intended, we get into very serious complications. One of the most uncomplicated thinkers in all time, I guess, was Confucius. Confucius was perfectly aware of what constituted a superior person. This superior person was a completely self-disciplined person. But he was not disciplined in a way that showed as discipline. He wasn't unkind to himself. He did not flagellate himself literally or symbolically. He did not become an austere, detached, antisocial character. The Confucian superior man was a perfectly adjusted person, not a person who was subject to various types of over-discipline or over-self-control. Confucius enjoyed life. He regretted that other scholars did not rise to cooperate in the reformation of China, but he did what he could, and he became notable for a very sincere, superior kind of living. In the recent regimes in China, he was cast aside as ancient and outlived and outworn. In the last 5 years, however, he has come back to become probably the ideal of Chinese character, namely perfect poise, integrity, warm sympathy, but everything under control. Nothing getting away. No temper fits. No outbursts. No revenges. No hatreds. No bickerings. No slanders. No effort to revenge or retaliate for real or imaginary wrongs. But quietly and serenely to live according to the three principles. To do this is therefore to conserve all resources to the greatest possible degree. We will not waste energy if we control ourselves without it being necessary to use energy to control ourselves. This is the difficulty. We put an iron fist on ourselves. We lock ourselves with a tremendous effort of the will, as in the case of trying to break a bad habit. But the energy that we use to get over the bad habit is almost as detrimental in its usages as the habit was. The thing is that we relax away from anything that is not right. We do not fight for a certain attitude. We relax away from that which interferes with that attitude. It is like Socrates and his statue. He told his friends that he got a block of marble, and that he cut away that part of the marble which didn't belong and didn't seem to work very well. When he got all through trimming the marble, he had the statue. Now, it is much this way of taking the rough granite of our own natures. Instead of trying to dream all the time about the great artistry we are going to achieve, if we just could chip away the parts that are not necessary, if we chip away the mistakes, if we just simply quietly go about doing the things that are right, if we remove that which is unnecessary, unreasonable, unfair, dishonest or dishonorable, just removing these things one at a time, when we get through, the statue in all its beauty stands revealed to us. The real self is that which is revealed when the not-self is overcome. And the not-self is overcome not by fighting it, but by outgrowing it, by living above it, not with strain and effort, but with a very gentle, quiet way of doing things. It is perfectly possible to be true to yourself, to fight the good fight, so-called, and to live a good and enlightened life without a great mass of conflicts. I know, for instance, that in families now, there are tremendous conflicts in which individuals resent each other, in which the family situation is falling apart, and hard feeling is abroad in the land in almost all homes. The only answer to the situation is that all this bad feeling does not add up to anything. The only answer to it is that each individual must ultimately come to the point where he recognizes the need to conserve energy by wasting none of it on dissension. And therefore, in a quiet and pleasant way, he adjusts to that which is necessary, and he quietly steps aside against that which is unnecessary. He does all that it is supposed he should do. He does not walk out on a duty. He does not avoid a responsibility. He does not reject a lesson. But he accepts all of these things quietly and with dignity. This was the code of Francis de Assis, and it is a very difficult code to excel. But it is also the code by means of which energy is restored. Energy is saved. Energy is guarded by this type of thing. Now, the next phase of the energy is that every attitude that we have has some type of a reflex on the body itself. Every temper fit does much more than upset us emotionally. It upsets the body chemistry. Every mistake that we make in the personality, every act of violence, every joining into riots, into violence against society, everything of this kind accomplishes no good primarily, but also damages the person who is guilty of it. Now, people will say, well, there are 100,000 people that don't like something and are fighting it. Probably true. But the moment you join that group, you begin to destroy yourself. And each of those that is in that group is destroying themselves rather than achieving their ends. And if we look around us today to see what violence is producing, we see that it produces nothing but violence. And that violence in our personal lives, whether it's intellectual or physical, produce nothing but distress. So it's all of these emotional pressures, jealousy and vanity and self-centeredness and rejection of the common experiences of life, mistakes of this kind interfere with health. They begin to break down the body chemistry, because the body itself, like the body of the solar system, is an outlet, a means for the expression of energy. And when the body is corrupted, the flow of energy is disturbed. The moment the flow of energy is disturbed, various types of obstruction arise. And wherever obstruction arises in the human body, death sets in. Obstruction is tension. Tension arises from the misuse of energy. And wherever it exists, it must, in every possible way, be relaxed. Now, most people who come and talk to you about these things say, yes, they would be very happy to relax the energy, get rid of the tension, and do all these things if other people would agree with them. Everyone would be able to live beautifully if somebody else wasn't interfering. But there is always a person or a circumstance that is nagging. And this consequence forces the individual to build up these defenses of tension and stress. This is entirely erroneous. The more tension there is on the outside, the more need there is for complete internal passivity, a peace. Now, a peace also suggests a number of other things. One, where to find it. Well, that is curing itself pretty much these days. There's no place you can go. There is no place where you can be sure that peace is going to stay very long. There is no security in human society today. Perhaps the first lesson this teaches us is to get over the idea of escaping. Now, we do still have certain monastic escapes, certain retreats and places of this kind. And somewhere in the midst of the distant mountains, we find the hermits who have left society to cultivate their own detachments. But for the most part, all of these people have weakened themselves by these attitudes. There is no way of gaining a position in life where relaxation is available without personal effort. There is no relaxation unless the individual makes the changes within himself. If he makes these changes within himself, relaxation is possible wherever he is. There's the old story about the Tibetan priests who do their meditation while surrounding a great bell that gongs all the time to disturb them, and they don't even hear it. You do not actually shut out the sounds around you or the pressures. You simply solve them by dissolving them in quietude. Quietude doesn't mean you accept what you do not believe or compromise anything. But quietude gives you the perfect calmness with which to make the simple decision of right and wrong, the simple solution to the problem without dramatization or emotionalization, comes as the result of internal quietude. And internal quietude is the thing that helps to protect energy resources within yourself. Without this internal quietude, your energy resources cannot be adequately preserved. Now, another problem that then comes along, of course, is that the body, with its energies, has a few remarks to make and a few contributions to this problem. Today, for example, we have more people health conscious in this country than probably ever before in history. And I think it is safe to say we have more sick people. I read not long ago that we have 80 million people in this country reducing, of whom 40 million are doing it wrong. We have people who are doing everything they can possibly do, but what are the motives? The motives to various forms of health have to be very carefully considered. Unless the motive for reduction is more than merely cosmetic, it is really very much a mistake. Because the real reason of all things is to protect and preserve health. And that which is not necessary to the protection and preservation of health is not a worthy occupation for the health seeker. All kinds of extreme methods are being used, mostly in an effort to compensate for extreme delinquencies. We have people who have followed up to 200 different diets. Some of them, of course, we'll never know what happened because they didn't last through the 200 diets. Around the middle of the list, they passed out. But, of course, having passed out, they issued no affidavit or made no statement to discourage others. They just all kept on going. The problem with health, again, is energy preservation and protection. The purpose of food, which is derived largely from this great battery, which we call the earth, the energy of food is to maintain and protect life. Any form of nutrition which does not essentially fulfill this need is not necessary or advantageous. Many people eat all kinds of things that make them miserable in an effort to accomplish some cosmetic result. This is not the answer. If the person understands life, if the person comes into direct contact with the rules of the game, he will naturally and of his own accord keep those rules. But if they are forced upon him by others, or he is lured into them by ulterior motives, then this is not true. So in the matter of maintaining the physical health, again, the physical health depends upon the quietude of the body and the fact that the body does that which it was created to do. The body has a purpose. If that purpose is fulfilled, the body is happy. But if the body is made the object of too much concern, it becomes embarrassed and begins to result in defects of health. The body should be left very quietly to the fulfillment of its own needs. And on one occasion, Plato referred to a young dude in the Athenian colony, Alcibiades. He said, "Here we have a red dagger in a jeweled sheath. We have a body that is just the body of a fop, a body that is covered with the finest raiments and the greatest jewelry, and which has a great pride in itself. And inside, it is nothing. There is nothing there but surface." Now, this is something that ultimately will destroy the body, because surface alone leads to dissipation. The body is a useful purpose. It is there for us to use. If we abuse it, we suffer. If we use it, we gain a great deal of help and cooperation from it. But the body is not to be intended as the ruler of the life. The body is not to be taken as proceeding in authority or in purpose all the rest of our existence. We are not here to be servants of the flesh. We are not here to devote all our waking time to trying to develop muscle or brawn. We are here to use the body as we would use a good vehicle. If we have a good car, we will keep it up because we need it. In the old days, we had a horse and buggy. We fed the horse well so that it was properly curried and stabled in order that it might fulfill its purpose. But gradually in this modern world, we have developed the famous paint sign motto, "Save the surface and you save all." Most people kill themselves trying to save the surface. So use the body, but decide how to use it. And recognize that in the conservation of energy, that the complete cooperation between the body and the person in the body is necessary to energy conservation. We have to plan our lives. I suppose Muhammad was one of the best life planners that we know. He divided the 24-hour rule of the 24-hour of the day, the 24-inch rule, into 3 8-hour sections. One he gave to the world to help and to carry on his ministry in order that his labors might be of service to God. The second 8 hours he devoted to his family, to his personal happiness and growth, to enjoying the reasonable and proper pleasures of life. And the third 8 hour period he gave over to sleep, relaxation, and rest. Now, this is not a bad type of division. We would have many more healthy people if we had the three divisions of time into 8 hours. Today, we have very little problem with the 8 hours of work. We had a little work done not long ago by some tradespeople who came in to work. We didn't have to worry about them overworking, I can assure you. They were working by the day. They arrived at 10 o'clock in the morning and left at 3 in the afternoon. Certainly this gave them plenty of energy to do something else with. They did not have to work from dawn to dark as we used to in the older days. They did not have to go out and milk 3 or 4 cows before breakfast. They had a great deal of time, and 8 hours devoted to business, transaction, to career, to employment is almost an actual law today. Anyone works more than that gets overtime. So the 8 hours for work, or for service, or to go out and do the things that help others, or to variously contribute to the well-being of the community, these possibilities fit well into the 8 hour period. Now, the 8 hours of sleep, this is a little different, but we still mostly abide by it. And while we are asleep, we don't waste very much energy. But in sleep, we also have a breaking down of the wear and tear of the day. And if the waking hours have been well used, the sleeping hours will be reasonably efficient. Sometimes we have difficulties, everyone has them. But for the most part, we'll be able to keep that 8 hour span pretty well. The work is right because we're using the energy that is given to us for work. The rest is right because we are using it to relax and restore the energies. The big problem is the remaining 8 hours. Here we have the 8 hours to do as we please. Here are the hours of self-improvement, rest, relaxation, study, pleasure, family, friends, children. And I would say that this group of 8 hours is in miserable condition at the present time. Our idea now of 8 hours of happiness and pleasure is television. Here we sit and watch murders for 8 hours. And also occasionally get a brighter moment from a commercial. Also, if we are not doing that, we are doing all kinds of wasteful, useless things. We are going out and drinking too much. We are keeping up a social life that doesn't mean anything. We are possibly indulging in the narcotic culture. Or perhaps we are simply sitting around fussing, reading the newspaper, worrying about the world, and very largely ignoring the better type of life. We are not giving the children proper attention. We are not giving the family proper attention. Nothing is falling apart. Now, this is where the part of our psychic integration, which corresponds to the 7 planets, or the soul section of man's triune nature, of spirit, soul, and body. It is the soul structure which is the part that is giving us the great trouble. Here we have conflicts, we have confusions, we have ambitions overruling common sense, we have the gratification of sensory perceptions without end, we have a tremendous struggle for luxuries, we are afraid to economize. We want to try to maintain a level of economics that is falling apart underneath us. And we are not doing anything with that 8 hour period, which is perhaps one of the most important of our entire life. We make a living in one 8 hour period and throw it away in another. We work hard to get something, and when we get it, it's no good to us. So we have to take this psychic area of our 8 hour period and try to see what we can do to use it to reorganize our energy resources, to keep ourselves from wasting the energy that we ought to be building up. We eat in order to live, and then we turn around and live only to eat. Everything gets into trouble. It gets too much of everything. So in this 8 hour period, what we are supposed to do is to develop the over-self, to provide the life with steering gear, provide it with motives, provide it with opportunities to grow, to become better human beings and to become more significant human beings. In the sleeping period, we are little better than vegetables. We are sound asleep. In the working period, we're a little better than draft animals because we are laboring. These are two things that have to be more or less handled. But in this other part, this other third, our humanity can take over. And it is especially important that our humanity does take over if we wish to bring a solution to any of the problems of modern living. unless we make that part, that 8 hour of rest and relaxation, very important, we're never going to get out of the present problem. We should use at least a good part of that in quest for basic self-improvement. We should study. We should think. We should develop talents. This 8 hour period is the opportunity in our lives to bring something forth out of ourselves. This is the part that is ourselves. Here is our chance to be ourselves. We are not John Smith while we're working. We're not John Smith while we're sleeping. But we're John Smith when we take hold of our lives and build a personality for John Smith. To make him an important person. To make him gradually unfold the resources so that when he leaves this world, he will be better and not merely older than when he came here. To go out of this world at the end of 70 or 80 years, knowing no more than when we entered, starting out by wanting to be wasteful and dying wasteful, actually beginning life full of opinions and dying with the same opinions or others just as bad, this is a complete loss of life. It is a very interesting situation because something was brought to my personal attention, a little story on me. Many, many years before the war, I inherited a Japanese houseboy. I inherited him because I had him for a couple of months to help me. Then I told him I couldn't afford to keep him, so he said he'd stay without pay. It was a beautiful arrangement. But I was working very hard, writing and lecturing out a great deal of the time. And my library at that time was in my home. So one evening I come home, and here is Asa, my houseboy, sitting on the edge of a fireplace in the living room with my choicest books piled up in front of him and a beautiful fire burning in the grate. I said, "What are you going to do, Asa?" He says, "I'm just going to burn them." I said, "They're not yours." He said, "I'm burning them." "Well, they belong to me." He said, "You won't be here to enjoy them." And he gave me a good solid talk on why it was that if I didn't ease up a little bit, there'd be no use to have anything. That if you become dominated by some situation that prevents you from being able to ventilate your own life, you will ultimately get into trouble. So it is very important that 8 hours of doing the things that enrich life. One way, I think, is to realize that in this area we have the whole field of the arts, creative self-expression. Now, arts, of course, here's where a little spot where I think the lunar factor comes in. That part of the solar energy which has to do with art also bounces off of the moon occasionally and produces what we call today, post-impressionism. Art that you can't do a thing with. Art which does not have within it one bit of psychic life. It does not help you to grow. It does not express any creative conviction, and very often is motivated entirely by commercialism. There, you're wasting your energy. But you have to place your own censorship on this energy and the use of it. But creative art is very important. Music is important.